The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey, welcome to Breaking Banks, the first and number one global fintech show. This is Rachel Morrissey. I am the executive producer of Breaking Banks. Brett is about to go on stage for Credit Union Australia, so he can't be here today. But we've been working really hard with our friends JP Nichols and Jason Henricks on some new projects that I wanted to share with you today. Before we get to that, we have our ever-popular conference announcements. They're important and they're good deals. So everybody likes a good deal here, right? We like our money. And also, these are in chronological order, so please forgive me if you are down the list. It is not because we think you are unimportant. Now, Finovate is next week in New York City, September 11th through 14th. It has an expanded program for Finovate Fall. Register now at fall2017.finovate.com and make sure you enter our special partner promotional code, BREAKINGBANKS20, to save 20% on the current ticket price. We are going to be there. Brett will be there on Monday and Tuesday for sure. I will also be there. We hope to see you there. Also, next week on September 11th, NYPay is having their 6th annual UnConference with Consult Hyperion, which is run by one of our favorite people, Dave Birch. Go to nypay.org events and use the code BREAKINGBANKS25 for a 25% discount. That is BREAKINGBANKS25 and you'll get 25% off. This year's PayThink Conference is taking place September 18th to 20th at the Biltmore Resort in Phoenix, Arizona. You'll hear from the industry leaders like Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Navy Federal, and the innovators like Alipay and Uber and Ally Bank. Listeners to Breaking Banks can get an exclusive $250 discount by using the promo code BREAKING, and you can check out more details at the paythinkforum.com. Use the code BREAKING and you'll get a $250 discount. Next Money Chicago is September 26, 2017. The Breaking Banks family will all be there. Brett King will be speaking, JP Nichols is hosting, Ron Shevlin, Jason Henricks, Jim Maroos, Dwayna Blomstrom, they're all on stage. Go to nextmoney.org to register now. NYPay is also planning another event on October 3rd. It's called Retail's Drive to Digital, Tools and Tactics. You go to nypay.org events, use the code BREAKINGBANKS25, and you get 25% off. I'm sure that they're going to be talking to OmniPay, or OmniWay, as it's now called. Registration has begun for BAI Beacon in Atlanta on October 4th and 5th. They have a particularly interesting track that they designed with Matteo Rizzi, who never disappoints. Think of a banker. Now think of the opposite of a banker, and that's what Matteo Rizzi looks like. He looks like a rock star talking about banking. We will be there. Our listeners can get a discount with the code B32. And Money 2020 US is in Las Vegas on October 22nd through 25th. Provoke Media, which includes Breaking Banks, FinTech 5, and JP Nichols' new show, Serial Entrepreneur, are all pleased to be part of the exclusive podcast network. Look for episodes of the FinTech 5 in the Money 2020 website. Now, for a treat. While we were in Copenhagen at Money 2020 Europe, we got the chance to begin recording JP Nichols' upcoming show, Serial Entrepreneur. This will be available for download in 2 weeks with lots of great shows to follow. We wanted to give you a little taste now, so we are broadcasting it today. So without further ado, we introduce the Serial Entrepreneur.
I was so convinced that I knew all about running technology, all about governance. You know, I knew an awful lot, but most of that was wrong.
We rightly celebrate the struggles of startups and their brave founders, but it can be tough working in a bigger company too, where powerful corporate antibodies seek and destroy new ideas that don't conform to the conventional culture. But some leaders battle the status quo inside their own companies to innovate and drive change. These are the serial entrepreneurs, and this is their story.
I'm Ann Bowden, and I'm the CEO and founder of Starling Bank.
And you have been a serial entrepreneur for a long time, but you've turned entrepreneur now.
Yeah.
You've actually went out and started a bank, no easy feat.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about that. Well, maybe we'll start there. So tell everybody what Starling Bank is and kind of the quick story on that. And I want to go back and talk about the rest of your career too.
I think Starling Bank stems from my career as a long-term banker and technologist. Somebody said to me, I had to do it. I had to start my own bank. Starling Bank is a bank for, well, it's of the time. It's a bank for people who live their life on the mobile. It's all about technology. It's all about bringing all those great things that people have in other parts of their life to their banking product.
Right, because there's been a big disconnect for a long time.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I came to the conclusion that we'd gone into the financial services crisis, we'd come out again. Technology had changed, the regulation had changed, people had changed. People were far more, well, they were smarter. They understood how to get the right sort of products for the right sort of thing they wanted to do. And nobody's bringing them together. So I had to do it. I had to start the process of bringing people together to start a new bank.
So you've been creating change inside of other organizations, and you eventually got to the point where to do it the way you really wanted to do it, you just had to do it yourself. Is that it?
Yeah, I think I first tried to do it internally and came to the conclusion it was easier to do it externally and start again. At the time, I thought it was going to be a lot easier. It turned out to be very, very hard. Starting a bank is not for the faint-hearted. But we've had 3-4 years now of working on this proposition, and we're in a really, really good place. But it's quite a story.
It is. Well, let's talk about your story. So walk us back through, what was your childhood like? Where did you grow up?
I grew out in South Wales in the UK. I went to the local school. I was an only child of sort of older parents. And I loved technology from an early age. For my fifth birthday, I was bought a reel-to-reel tape recorder. I was into tech from 4 or 5, and I loved every minute of it. And I was also into fashion. So it is fashion and tech. And that's really how it's always been.
So what did you do with that reel-to-reel tape recorder?
Well, I used to tape and record my friends sort of discussing things, and I never actually got more than sort of 2 tapes. Somehow I sort of recorded them and over-recorded them for years on end, but it was fun, and it was quite new at the time, and I really enjoyed myself.
You were a podcaster way ahead of your time.
I think I was, actually, although I've had a bit of a gap.
So how about university?
At university, I studied computer science and chemistry. It was an odd combination. I didn't really like chemistry. It just involved lots of lab work and lots of sort of things going on fire and things. And there was
strange geometric shapes.
Yeah. But the computer science lab was wonderful. Yeah. It was all about logic. It was all about doing things that, creating things. It was fun. And I think I spent most of my 3 years in the computer science department rather than chemistry.
So what was your plan at that time majoring in computer science? What did you think your career path would look like?
I wanted to do something quite scientific. I wanted to do something bringing science and computing together. And after university, I started looking for jobs in rural areas, doing sort of studying, you know, sort of quite complex scientific stuff. And I finished up working for a bank in the middle of London.
How did that come about?
And my mother said to me, you have to apply for one job in a bank. Just make me happy. Just apply for one normal job rather than these weird things.
So computer science seemed weird to your family at the time, and a bank was a proper, stable job.
Yeah, that was a proper job.
Yeah.
So I applied for one job in a bank. It was the first time that... Well, I think the second year that Lloyds Bank were hiring computer science grads.
So that was new then?
Yeah, very, very new.
This is in the early 80s.
The early 80s. And I went up to London for my interview, and I found out there were 1,000 people being sort of sifted, and 100 had been employed, brought to London. And I got the job, one of 30. And all of a sudden, my life changed.
Yeah, this was as a programmer?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was great.
So this is COBOL. This is like mainframe stuff.
No, it's actually post-COBOL. It was actually things like PL1 and all that sort of stuff. And it was a great year. It was, I learned the new languages, learned how big systems worked, and then spent 6 months in a branch. So I'm one of the few people that's actually worked as a teller in a branch.
Right.
So for 6 months, you went into a branch, you did every single job, from being the teller to going right way through to going out with the manager to visit business clients. And it was a fantastic opportunity, but it's a real, real pain because I kept suggesting changes to everything. And you weren't supposed to suggest changes as a graduate in a branch.
You were just supposed to learn and do what we always do because we're the smart people and we figured this out already.
Yeah. I'm not very good at fitting in. That was a bit of a challenge.
They weren't prepared for that. Well, so you spent 4 years at Lloyds, and then it seemed you really started to progress after that. You took on some responsibility. So how did that come about? Tell us the story
I had a big opportunity. I was at Lloyds Bank when, the Child Committee in the UK opened up the clearing system, the CHAPS system, to other banks. And I knew all about CHAPS, the clearinghouse payment system. And I was hired by Standard Chartered into a very much more senior job. I thrived, to be honest. I was given a chance to leap up a few levels, and I grasped the opportunity. And that was my first big job.
Was that a big stretch for you to take on a role there? So you were head of systems and process for UK corporate banking, right?
Yeah. I didn't know what I was doing. I was learning fast. It was a great opportunity. I sat at a very senior level in a senior management committee in the organization. I had a department, had an office.
Relatively early in your career.
Yeah, I was 26. And huge responsibilities. And I realized I didn't really have all the equipment for the job. So I started an MBA, did an MBA in the evenings. And I realized that there was more to life than running a sort of engineering department.
Mm-hmm. So 26 years old and a woman in this very male-dominated industry in the city of London, right? And a technologist to boot. You must have really been... Were you a fish out of water then?
I didn't know at the time.
You didn't know anybody.
No,
it felt good to you.
This is normal. This was the fact that there weren't many women, and that I was ambitious was unusual. But my boss told me that I'd never reached the top because I'd never been a consultant, and I took that pretty hard. When I got my MBA, I quit my job to become a consultant.
Did you like that?
No, not initially. It was quite different. I'd come from an organization which I was running something, responsible for something, and I was going into an organization where I was going from consulting role to consulting role, and not really being embedded in the organization. But I learned an awful lot. I think I learned a huge amount in PW. It gave me the skills to understand how the consulting process works, and it's really equipped me for managing consultants since then.
So, right, you were at what was then Pricewaterhouse for about 3 years, you got your fill of that, and then you were right back into financial services. Yeah. So progressive, areas of responsibility at UBS and Aon, and then ABN AMRO and Royal Bank of Scotland, and then finally AIB, Allied Irish Banks, were by 2012 your chief operating officer. So now you're at the very top of the pyramid.
Yeah.
What'd you learn along the way?
I think I learned that in order to build a career, you have to do lots of different things. So, you know, I had my stint in Zurich in corporate finance, corporate banking, in a rather a chief of staff sort of function. I then joined insurance, where I was chief information officer. Started doing a lot of M&A work for the organization and had my taste of more front office roles. In ABN AMRO, I was running front office transaction banking for Europe, Middle East, and Africa, very much a sales role, servicing some of the biggest companies in the world and cash management and transaction banking. RBS bought ABN AMRO, went to RBS, and I stood out of the job in 2012 and spent a year in fintech. And I realized that a lot of the things I was convinced about were right was actually wrong. I was so convinced that I knew all about running technology, all about governance. You know, I knew an awful lot, but most of that was wrong. And I started working with some fintechs, and they taught me far more than I taught them. And I spent some time going around the world trying to figure out what had happened in the financial crisis and what could have done better. So I was researching banking, finance, new ways of bringing finance to people who needed it, and technology. And somebody phoned me up and said, did you want to go into Allied Irish Banks as part of the rescue team, really, post-crisis? The bank had been through a lot, a big bailout.
They had a really hard time during the crisis.
Yeah. And I went in with a great management team.
Was that exciting to you, to take kind of a rescue?
It was huge.
That's something you hadn't really done up to that point in your career, right?
It was at a totally different level of engagement with society as a whole. You know, I'd always been deep in a big organization. You know, when you're working for an organization of 100,000 or more, you know, sort of you spend most of your time either with real clients, customers, or with other departments in the organization. AIB was an organization that that had a lot of external contact. With the community, with the nation as a whole that had gone through a terrible time with the banking system. And that really brought things to, you know, to a head for me. I could understand the impact that financial services were having on real people.
So what is an example of something that you found out later you were wrong about, something you felt strongly about and you learned that fintech had a different view?
I think one of the first things that that I was convinced about was that the only way of delivering capable solutions was by using lots of different vendors and bringing those vendors together in various outsourcing solutions to address a problem. But I realized that the world has moved on. It is now possible to have a really, really good engineering team bringing together a plug-and-play world and building technology from scratch to create great solutions. And I often say we have something like 40 engineers in Starling. I'm used to dealing with something like 4,000, you know, it's sort of, but we produce so much because we have a different engagement model. And it had been very, very difficult to convince me 5 years ago that it would be possible to build a bank the way we have.
So 40 engineers out of how many total employees?
100 people.
So have you ever worked at an organization where engineers were 40% of your employee base?
We are much more of a technology organization than anything else. Starling is wonderful because the culture is all about how we can create stuff for people. And it's very technology centered. And the engineers have an awful lot of authority, to drive the direction of the business. It is a very, very different culture from lots of the organizations I've worked at.
So you spent 30 years climbing the corporate ladder quite successfully, yet you were never quite that corporate drone, right?
No,
you were always an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
You were trying new things. What was the first time you really brought some crazy idea to your boss and they looked at you like you were nuts?
I think that what I'm particularly good at is driving change, that backing an idea and making sure it happens. I've now totally changed my view of, you know, outsourcing and using vendors in a certain way. But back in the early days, back in 2000, and I was convinced that the only way to actually drive change in the organization is by having external influence of outsourcing relationships. And I remember facing a huge amount of internal kickback to taking the view that we had to embark upon a huge transformation program. And the only way we could actually get it done and get the money for it if we wrapped it into a big outsourcing deal.
So and the conventional thinking was, we need to have our people do this. It's so critical, so important that the only way we can do this, the only people we can trust is ourselves.
Yeah.
And you had a radical view that we could actually do this better, faster, with outside help.
Yeah. So it turned out to be actually quite right in that at that time, it was the only way to get that done. And I remember being told that it was quite difficult to get the US board bought into this. So within 2 hours, I'd bought a ticket to Chicago and was on a plane.
So you knew that if you were going to make the case, you needed to do it face to face with the board in Chicago.
Yeah.
How'd you make the case?
I think I sort of, I pitched beforehand, got on the phone, explained to people that it was very, very important. That this was our chance to really transform the organization. It was our chance to do it in a way we could afford it. It was a way that's going to get things done with least risk to the organization. And we need to get it done quickly. And I had no patience for hanging around for 6 months whilst we went through the various committees. So I'm on my way to Heathrow. I'll be there later on today, can I see somebody this afternoon? I must admit, it's happened once or twice in my career, turning up outside people's offices.
So this wasn't new for you?
No, that's not new.
Yeah, you at least fired the warning shot. I'm on my way to Heathrow, so beware.
Yeah. And the people are very, very good. I think that, the common themes between entrepreneurship and doing the same thing in an organization is, you have to decide to do the right thing for the company at any particular point in time. And there's right and wrong, and you know what right is. And every executive has the duty to make sure the right decision is made. And if that means putting your career on the line or your personal, integrity on the line and actually going in there and saying, I will do this and I will deliver that, that's important.
Yet so often that doesn't happen. Why not? What are people afraid of from actually making it? It sounds easy when you say it.
Yeah.
We know what the right thing is. We just have to have the courage of our conviction and do it. And yet we see so many examples when that's not what happens.
I think corporate life is very tough. I think that it is, we're at Money 2020 and we're talking about there was a game show yesterday, the corporates against the risk takers, the entrepreneurs. And people think us in, entrepreneurs are risk takers. People who are entrepreneurs tend to take the risk early in their career or late in their career. The majority of people working in big corporates are mid-career. They have families and careers to worry about.
They have something to lose.
Yeah. And it is tough. It is tough to survive those middle years. And you have to think very, very carefully about the decisions you're taking. Most people are under pressure to conform, and perhaps conforming is not good for the organization as a whole.
Did you feel pressure to conform?
Yeah. And I think that I probably didn't.
You've been the rebel.
Yeah.
For a long time.
Yeah.
So you didn't feel that pressure of family to support and a career arc?
No.
Well, why do you think that is?
I think that I quite enjoy the day-to-day challenge of running a business. I think it creates a lot of adrenaline. You know, people say to me at the moment, being an entrepreneur, doing what you're doing at the moment, starting a new bank, it must be full on. It must be very, very sort of pressured. Well, not as much the corporate job. You know, it's been 35 years of this.
It's a different kind of pressure.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So did you always know that eventually, someday, I'm going to go start my own thing? Or did that decision come later in your career?
I think I always wanted to do my own thing. I think it is always the plan that once I'd done my corporate career, I'd do something else entrepreneurial. My corporate career kept going on and on, and I kept enjoying the lovely next step of it all. Finally, I came to the conclusion that I had to do a bank. The climate was perfect. I had to start a bank because so many things were going in the right direction. It was a timing.
So now you're the CEO.
Yep.
There's nobody above you to make any countermands on your decisions and so on. So part of your role now, and it has been in many of the last few years of your career, part of your role now is helping other people to create change from within. Do you worry that people are afraid to countermand you because you must be the smart one?
I think that being CEO of the bank is a bit different from that. We are a regulated, fully licensed bank. So it is very, very important that you have the challenge around you. At Starling, we have a very, very capable and professional board of directors, independent directors, that are responsible for setting the strategy and steering the big strategic decisions of the organization. We're also heavily regulated. We're regulated by the PRA and the FCA in the UK. So being the CEO doesn't mean you call all the shots. We have a responsibility to our customers and to the economy and to the to everybody else in the UK to make sure the bank is well run. And that's not just me. We have a very, very structured governance structure. For example, we have our first line, our second line internal audit, our third line, our external audit. We have risk functions. We have a very, very sort of powerful and independent board. And we have the regulators. So my job is just as much making sure that we manage all those relationships just as much as managing the organization. But the great thing about being in a different organization such as Starling, it's very, very different in culture from any of the banks I've ever worked with. It's a great place to be, and I feel that we are creating something together for the good. And it's great to have a mission which is more than just making money.
Can edit that out now since you weren't talking. Do you want your people to challenge you?
Yeah.
How do you encourage them to do that?
I think that we debate a lot. We debate. I tend to quite like working with people that are very interesting and very competent and that hold contrary views. We are quite a vocal group. I think I enjoy the debate, but then in the end we need to make a decision and move on. But I think we do things together.
One of my favorite quotes is from General Colin Powell, who says, "I expect vigorous debate while a decision is being made. But once a decision is made, I expect you to carry it out as if it were your own."
Yeah, I think that I got a slightly different feeling about this. I think that there's too much weight put on making decisions and coming up with firm plans and executing them. There's nothing like having optionality. Let's keep everything open until we have to make that decision. But then when we make a decision, make it quickly. Let's understand our environment. Let's be open to all those new things out there. Let's shuffle all those ideas and lay the plans in place one stage at a time, so we can react to the environment as it develops.
So that's typically not the culture inside a large bank or any large company, really. How have you encouraged others, and maybe now or maybe in the past in other roles, to have that kind of let's wait and see kind of mentality?
I think that what we're trying to encourage is the fact that you can answer people's questions about the future and give them reassurance about the future whilst keeping your plans as fluid as possible. You know, I went through the whole era where project management and project delivery was all about doing the Gantt chart.
Right.
And then reporting against the
Gantt
chart.
We got it all figured out up front. Now all we have to do is track it.
Yeah. And to be honest, the majority of projects I delivered that way, we never got the end of the Gantt chart. Okay?
Right.
You know, the world didn't work like that. So modern ways of delivery are very much... you know, coming up with the goals, figuring out what you're going to do, minimal viable product, agile methodologies, really working on a very visual way of working through what we're going to do this week, what we're going to do next week, what we're going to do the next week after. One of the interesting things I did when I went into AIB was to move away from a methodology of Gantt charts and project steering committees to the only thing that matters is the demo. So the demo happened every Thursday in my office, and the only thing that mattered was what we developed and could demo on that Thursday. And that rhythm of having to do things at work that exist rather than having a whole method of driving projects which are basically status report driven, I think can transform an organization.
So those are the philosophies and methodologies that have driven technology companies, right? This is the ethos of Silicon Valley and in London, Silicon Roundabout and Shoreditch and other places, but not necessarily in the high street banks. So yeah. It's a part of what has created the opportunity for change for you to be able to embrace that and then bring it to a new institution.
And I think that a lot of the big banks are trying to work on these agile methodologies. You know, the big banks are full of very, very smart people trying to do a good job. Yeah. But the problem they're trying to solve is huge. And, you know, we as the new startup banks are actually trying to address a smaller problem that's very specific for people's needs.
So who inspired you earlier in your career, either somebody you knew directly or maybe more of a public figure?
I can't really name people specifically that... that have been role models for me. I think there are very few senior women that could act as role models for people in my role. I work with June Drury in Aon Corporation, who was the global CIO of Aon Corporation. And she was, you know, very inspiring. And she has gone on to do great things coaching other women.
Do you have any favorite business books?
Yeah, the hard thing about hard things.
Mark Andreessen.
Yeah.
Ben Horowitz.
Ben Horowitz. And that reminds me of Starling. Okay. We set out to do something very, very hard. Starting a bank, and not just a bank that's doing you know, sort of lending or mortgages, that's doing current account banking, that has issues cards and has direct access to payments and does all the difficult things.
Real-time transactions, yeah. 24/7.
And then deciding to build the technology yourself and not buy a banking package. And then go for a full banking license. That was a hard thing. And it's really, really worthwhile because it gives real value to people. So we've set out to do a hard thing, and along the way it's been very hard. And starting a bank is not for the faint-hearted, but I'm really, really sort of pleased that we've done it this way and we have something that's really worthwhile.
Did you choose the hard way just because you like a big challenge, or that was the right way to do what you wanted to do?
I think it's a question of it's easy enough to do something that's peripheral, that's not that difficult, but doesn't actually really change things. If you're going to spend 5 years, 10 years, 15 years of your life working on something, it better make a difference. And the only way we could really make a difference was to do something fundamentally different in terms of business model, in terms of technology, in terms of being so integral into people's day-to-day lives. To spend that amount of time working on something, it better be worthwhile.
Do you have a favorite saying or quote that you like to share or maybe have tacked up on your wall?
I think that when people normally sort of ask me in a sort of femtech sort of way, or the female founder sort of way, I talk about Madeleine Albright's sort of phrase, there's a special place for hell in hell for women that don't help other women. And I think that, you know, there's a certain truism about that. Men help other men. It is harder for women to help other women because they're so busy, you know, fighting all the other things they have to fight. And the question is, there's so few of us, and we have so much to do. But the sad thing is, you know, I've been in this industry 30, 35 years. Things haven't really changed. When I started, there were hardly any women doing tech and finance and entrepreneurship. It's the same now. So we've got to do something different. Otherwise, it'd be the same position in 30 years' time.
So where do we go from here? What's the vision for Starling?
I think Starling's unlike any other bank. We're not setting out to actually create a bank that looks like incumbent banks, like traditional banks. We see ourselves as being a centre of an ecosystem. We will provide the current account, checking account, your everyday banking with a card and access to payment systems. We'll gather all the data for people's own benefit, not the benefit of the bank. We'll use machine learning and artificial intelligence to give you insight. And we'll be part of an ecosystem using open APIs and a marketplace. And together with all these other members of the marketplace, we'll change banking forever.
Awesome. Thank you.
I'm JP Nichols. This has been the Serial Entrepreneur Podcast. If you like the show, please give it a 5-star rating. That really helps other people discover it. You can also learn more and support this and all the other great podcasts from Provoke Media at provoke.fm.
Thank you all for tuning into Breaking Banks this week. If you go to iTunes and subscribe, I would be so grateful. Brett will be back next week with a great show for FinTech Week in New York City. Have a wonderful week. We will hope to see you then on Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time for more of the latest in fintech news.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.